This setup, obviously, if anybody's been to our Unity branches, this is not our normal setup. And so I'm going to do a little bit of this as I talk. And you can tell I'm prepared. I was telling people I have my facilitator jacket on, so you know. So at the request of our co-host, Atticus People of Color Organization, we decided to do the circle seating. And what's the official name?
Fishbowl.
Fishbowl seating. You're right, brother? You're shaking your head. And what we want to do here is to start off with a dialogue with our elders, having a dialogue and us listening, taking notes, observing, so forth. And then we're going to switch out. So we're going to invert the fishbowl for the middle circle so that the dialogue can be had with the larger audience also being involved. Does that make sense for everybody? So that's what we're going to do. We are going to start off with introductions of our panelists. And even though, I think because of the time in which we're starting, we want to make sure, we want people to know exactly who it is they're speaking to, of course. But because of time and the number of panelists that we have in the middle circle, we're going to ask them to give very short bios and talk a little bit about their history, what formations they were involved in as organizers. And then we're going to start off with some questions to them. And the questions are just sort of starter questions, and hopefully they'll just engage in a dialogue, come back and forth about their experiences in the movement, what the lessons they learned were, and what things they think needs to happen today. So part of all of that is going to be part of the dialogue and discussion. So for our panelists, because you're sitting in this fishbowl situation, we're going to ask you to speak, to project a little bit. So it won't be a natural dialogue, right? This ain't at your couch after work, chilling with your friends, got a drink or two. If I was over, it'd be a drink or two. So we're going to ask you to keep your voices up, and that may be partly my role to help with that. So we're ready to get started. And again, people will find their seats, and as more people come in, we'll expand the fishbowl. Okay. And by the way, sorry, my name is Kamal, and I'm part of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, if I didn't do that earlier. We're going to start with you, Brenda.
Oh, okay. My name is Brenda Stokely. Also, people know me as Insia. I guess you could say I've been involved in what we call the movement or movements since the early 60s. So I guess that would be, what, about... quite a number of decades. I've been involved in the labor part of our movement and been active in several major unions, the last one being AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Been involved in a lot of housing struggles against police brutality. And now I'll leave it at that. So we can go around.
Okay, my name is Masai Hosey. I've been involved with the Black Panther Party. Somewhere around the 70s, I identified a whole lot more with the politics of the New African Independence Movement. 1975, I went to prison along with another comrade, and another comrade was killed as a member of the Black Liberation Army, and I claimed citizenship in the Republic of New Africa. Got out about 13 and a half years. Went back to doing some work around the independence movement along with some other formations and groups. At this time, I work for the American Friends Service Committee, monitoring human rights abuses in jails and prisons. I'm also on the National Organizing Body for Critical Resistance, which is about the abolition of the prison industrial complex. And I'm a member of the community, the international community of Imam Jamil Abdul Amin, man formerly known as H.R. Brown, and a representative for the International Committee in support of Imam Jamil Abdul Amin.
And I just want to let y'all know, Masai, those are actually reading glasses. He's not just trying to look militant.
Yeah, right.
I told him to come in here, like he got the glasses on or something. Go ahead, brother.
He told you that and you believed
it.
My name is Ashanti Alston. Like my comrade here, I'm from New Jersey, the land of great revolutionaries. I've been involved with the movements, like Brenda said, since I kind of say 67 with the rebellion in Plainfield in 1967. Moved through the Black Power Movement into the Black Panther Party by 1970, 71, and then into the ranks of the Black Liberation Army. Captured during a bank expropriation in New Haven, Connecticut in 74. Served about 12 years, you know, prisons and stuff. Came out like Safia, doing political prisoner work. I'm also one of the few from the Black Panther Party who identifies as an anarchist. I call myself sometimes a Balagunista, after Kwesi Balagun, you know, New African anarchist, Black Liberation Army, Black Panther. And the work I do now is mainly around political prisoners. I'm a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement in New York. In my little bio, I put Jive member, though, because I don't make many meetings and stuff, and I ain't paid my dues in a minute. So, but anyhow, mainly what I do right now is I speak, I get around, I do some speakings because I feel it's important to share, you know, our story, you know, so that you folks know what you need to know from our different experiences so that you can get whatever lessons you can get from that to be able to carry this struggle on to a very successful conclusion. And I'll leave it there.
I'm Cleo Silvers, and the first thing I want to tell you about myself is that I'm a rank and filer. In other words, I've never been a part of the top leadership of any of the organizations I've been involved in, but have always been at the lowest levels, organizing from the grassroots and on the street. I started out as a part of the takeover by the workers of Lincoln Hospital in 1967. From there, we developed the Think Lincoln Committee, went forward to the Health Revolutionary Union Movement. And as a member of the Health Revolutionary Union Movement, I was recruited into the Black Panther Party. In the Black Panther Party, I worked on the free breakfast program, health care programs. And at the time of the split in the Black Panther Party in 1969, almost exactly 40 years ago, when the New York 21 was arrested, members of the leadership, the New York 21, sent me to work with the Young Lords so we could continue the work of organizing around health care. So I became a member of the Young Lords. From HRUM and the Young Lords, based on the politics of that time, they decided that since we were organizing as healthcare workers, we were service workers, and we needed to connect with the industrial proletariat, who would be the workers who would make the revolution. So they voted to send me to Detroit to become a member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and work in an auto plant, which I did for 5 years. From there, about that time, there was the attempt to build the multinational new revolutionary Communist Party, which was a bust. We need to talk about why that was a bust. Anyway, from that point on, I've been organizing as a labor organizer and a community organizer throughout the country. I've worked in Boston, Chicago, Cincinnati, Helena, Arkansas, and of course Detroit, Los Angeles, and in New York, and I'm still working in New York. I live in Harlem, so I'm responsible to the people of Harlem. The role that I play now is mostly to try to interact with the youth. I'm on the board of directors of the Harlem Tennis Council, which attempts to work on issues around gentrification in Harlem. We need to talk about that issue. The chairman of the board of the Brett Forum, which we need to talk about that issue. But essentially what I do now is mostly community organizing and working on political prisoner issues and making sure that our communities unite. So hopefully the work is a bridge for unity in our movement.
I don't know how to follow. My name is Seko Owusu. I'm president of the Republic of New Africa, having been elected in November of 2008. I'm 60 years old, and I've been involved in this here movement for land and independence since 1967, when I, in the radical borough of Queens, I ran into Mutulu Shakur, Nikki Laborde, and Herman and Ferguson and them, and we started this journey to create an independent nation, and I've been doing that since 1970. Through that time, I've worked with student organizations at City College, you know, creating or damaging some things up there, but open admissions, worked at Lincoln Detox, creating acupuncture against drug addiction, and I've worked in a number of institutions that we created for young people in Brooklyn. Thank you.
So we have a couple of folks who we also expected to be in our circle who aren't here, so I'm just going to mention Brother Shet McDaniel, who may come, but Brother and Sister Herman and Ialua Ferguson had to cancel and they could not come, but those are also some very esteemed elders in our community. So just to get this conversation started, we wanted to bring people together to talk about the Black liberation struggle in a wide breadth and beyond, right? So we have folks here from the labor who've done more work maybe in labor, and more folks who've done work around nationalist politics and everything else in between all of that. But basically folks who've been radical in terms of their political organizing since the 60s, and to this day are still involved in organizing and radical and liberation politics. So I wanted to start off with a sort of simple question for you guys. What was your high point in the struggle? When you look back at the work that you've done and the time periods that you've been in, which has now spanned 40-some-odd years, what's been like the high point for y'all in terms of the work that you've been doing?
I think that the high points for me are always when people realize that they have to be the masters of their own faith. So I've seen it when workers say, I'm tired of the bullshit on the job and the boss, and I'm going to organize. Or I'm tired of the leaders of the union, and I'm going to take over the union. Or tenants who organize, or students who have organized. So those have always been the high points. But I think in the 60s overall, I think that the whole country was in movement. And so you had all stratas organizing. You had welfare mothers. So I think that was a point that we, semblance that we need to get back to. And I think we are getting back to that.
Okay, then Brenda gives me an easy one to follow up on, because I couldn't think of one particular high point. But what does come to mind is when I worked in Brooklyn with Ocean Hill Grounds with Tennis Association. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a combination of some BLA folks, Panthers, Young Lord, and it was organizing the folks to actually take over housing. Mm-hmm. And, like, you can see the power that they feel. And I think that was really a high point for me. I think the people were more organized than even so-called revolutionaries. I mean, we took over a particular building, and people appointed committees and things, and they would do things like, you couldn't do drugs, or you couldn't do certain things in the building. They had the security force. If you worked and you contributed to a common fund, if you didn't, you helped with things of security. You learned different languages because you worked. You're actually living with folks. And like folks were saying, it wasn't about rhetoric, about somebody's line. You know, Mao, Shea, all of them became real because folks was working. That was a high point. And when the police came, when they, you know, eventually came, it was like the people, again, were more organized and ready to defend it than some of the folks who were supposed to be organized. I mean, these folks really thought this with these buildings. But Brooklyn, during that whole period of time, was like folks was taking over property, over neighborhoods, and it was real cool. Those were high points for me. Even though the pigs were shooting, you know, and killing folks, it was like shooting back, too. But
you can say that today, man.
Yeah,
you
can say it. Okay.
I'll go. I think for me it was, there's a lot, but I think the one that kind of helped shape me was when Panthers started coming to our hometown in Plainfield. And you had people like Kamu, Twyman Myers, and others would come there, and like, here we are, these young high school students, we want to start a chapter. We want to be Panthers, and they would, like, walk us through it. So it was like we would go into the community, and they would show us how to, like,
talk that Panther talk. I had to, like, we had to read the newspapers every day. We had to, like, we had to learn the basics of organizing, and so every day they would come and, like, walk us through it. So here I am, this shy kid, you know, and they would put me out there.
Things have changed.
I'm still basically shy. But the high point was when they wouldn't be in Plainfield, and we had to do it.
That's right.
So it had to be now. It had to be our rap. It had to be our organizing. It had to be, like, the effort that we put into it. And I felt like my shyness starting to reduce, where I felt like I was becoming more who I wanted to be. You know, and it got to the point where we did good in Plainfield. We had a free, we started in the summer, so we had a free lunch program. We didn't have a free breakfast program. We had a storefront. We had another storefront for free clothing. Every day, we're either on the street corners or we're helping tenants and doing something. So it made me feel like I was coming into my own, you know. So those is like the moments I remember. That's my high point.
Go ahead.
Ladies.
This is interesting because it had me think. I had to think, what was the high point? And it might be sad, is that it's almost like nothing exists that I might have worked with, you know, other than the Republic of New Africa, meaning that there's no building, there's no monument saying, and really what I got from what everybody said, the what is with us and with me is the development, the growth, mm-hmm. seeing other people grow. I mean, that's really the best reason or the best selling point to be in this here movement, is the growth and how you're going to meet all these beautiful people. And so, I mean, the high point is meeting everybody that I know in my life who makes such contributions to changing the way the world is going. And so it all really started with, you know, me meeting Matulu Shakur, who's now a prisoner of war. And he started me off by just, at one point we were doing some kind of program, and he was supposed to get up and speak or introduce. And as I turned around to him, he pushed me in front of the crowd. So that was the high point. That was probably 1967, and I had to speak for the first time in front of about 50 people. And so that represents the high point, I think, that I got from everybody, but for me was that growth, that stepping out of the box, that coming forward with my skills and everybody's skills that we all meet. We meet all these people, and they have these gifts, and they're able to use those gifts, and that's the high point.
You know, I'm so glad that you asked that kind of question, because I have two high points. The first one is the unity that I found among the sisters in the Black Panther Party. You know, people talk about what happened inside the Black Panther Party, but in the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party, sisters were unified. Well, number one, we lived together. And some of us was responsible for taking care of the others was out selling the newspaper. Others was taking care of the kids. Others was cooking. So that, and others was reading to the ones that couldn't be there in our study group. So that was like really an amazing experience, because the whole thing about, and I'm so like struck by the fact that sisters compete with each other for who's the cutest. One of the things about being in the struggle, no, this is real. One of the things about being in the struggle is that we were competing, but in a positive way, for how much work we could do, how many newspapers you could sell, what was the level of your work, how many people you could organize, how many kids you could pick up for the free breakfast program. That was a kind of competition that took place. And it also leveled the playing field between the sisters and the brothers. So I want to say that's like really, that was a very, very important high point. The other high point for me was the unity between the Puerto Rican and African American community in New York City. That we lived together, and back to living together, and the communal thing, and this unity thing that happens, you know, the people being together and learning together and struggling and growing together, that whole thing. Black community, South Bronx was made up of 40% pretty much African Americans, 60% Puerto Ricans. We all lived in the same buildings and stuff. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of gangs going on. With the input of the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords, it became a struggle to unite. And the struggle was, we all here together, we all got the same problems, let's fight and build unity. And that's where hip-hop came from. I just want to just say that that's the whole relationship between blacks and Puerto Ricans in the Bronx built hip-hop. So this is a part of y'all's history where y'all, you know, where y'all at. So this is a high point. And the one more high point is being here and being able to share this with this history that we have with you is like the best high point and the most tremendous high point that I think any of us could have.
I just don't want to ask you guys, you know, so what was the low point? I don't want to get that dialogue going about.
Okay, yeah, let's go.
So you guys are talking to each other about kind of like, so, I mean, a lot of us, I would assume, kind of know the histories in general of the 60s and 70s when it comes to the movement. And we know about or heard about COINTELPRO and the government's reaction to the strength that was happening, the movement building that was happening. But let's talk a little bit about the internal dynamics of the organizations and what was happening in terms of the community, the outreach, and the building. In addition to COINTELPRO, right, where did people think things started to change, or maybe the high point, you know, we reached a point where folks were thinking revolution was happening, and then it didn't happen, right? For a lot of people, particularly in the 60s and maybe the early 70s. Where do people think, in addition to COINTELPRO, internally speaking, what was changing, what happened that kind of stopped some of that momentum, or what are the things we could have worked on, what y'all could have worked on at the time, that if we could do it one more time, this is kind of some of the stuff I might do differently.
Go ahead, Charlie. We're still dealing with it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we are still dealing with it. And for me, a lot of it, you mentioned COINTELPRO, I think is very important. And I throw this out. I think a lot of times folks say that they know about COINTELPRO, but it's like more like they read a novel. I really suggest to folks, they look at them government documents. And I think one of the things we didn't take into account was just how serious these folks were. So all the things we would have done, it was all things COINTELPRO influence. And people get out there now and they think like some things can be relatively easy and whatever. And again, if they don't know how deep this government really went, which goes back to POWs and political prisoner struggle, I think they'll do some of the same things we've done. And I think it's terrible because we lose lives like that. Another thing that has been pointed out, though, is that the need for study. I mean, like some of the other folks here mentioned study in the early days. I don't really see that now. And what happened is, like, if we had been, some of the formations had been more together ideologically, then COINTELPRO couldn't have done what it did. If we really know each other, we can't be tricked. But we didn't really know each other. The good and the bad. You know, I use the example of left and right sometimes with folks. You know, we may both be good, but my vision is going slightly this way, yours is that way. We didn't really discuss it prior. So when somebody throw that little seed in there about, you know, so-and-so's crossing you up, they're going this way. If we had talked in the beginning, I know they always was going that way. They're not doing nothing underhanded. So I believe, we really need to study. We really need to get into things like COINTELPRO and whatever we say we are part of. Because even though we throw out the thing like movement now, there was some sharpening during the year. There is those who struggle for land and independence, and that's a distinction. The dynamics of that struggle is different than those even for African Americans, you know, and we really got to look into that. So there's a movement, but whatever I say I'm about, I should be more into it because I really can't relate to you if I don't really know myself and those I say I'm a part of.
I think I was also involved in building the so-called New Left Party because everybody hated the Communist Party. People at the time that we were talking about building a new party is people had a summation of both the Communist Party as being too right and really being racist. And the Trotsky, same thing with the Trotskyite party. We felt that they didn't even honor the question of self-determination and the right to land. So people felt that there needed to be something new, and it was all different nationalities. So a lot of study groups developed, and they were mainly among youth, if you want to call them that. They were a little bit older than some of y'all sitting in this room, but some of them were young, too. And all different nationalities. You had Asian study groups. You had Latino study groups. You had both Puerto Rican and people, Chicanos. You had indigenous study groups. You had African-American study groups. One of the errors, and I first of all, COINTELPRO will always be there. It's here now. But what it plays on are your internal weaknesses. We didn't grapple sometimes, and also our liberalism, that people could come back in, like the security people were some of the main folks, never had to say anything, were always in the top meetings, and some of the agents were the security people. So it's like, you know, like just embracing everybody because we wanted them to be in the movement, and not sort of, when we saw things that weren't right, we never really challenged some of them. Some people challenged them, like in the left movement, some people went overboard in terms of how they grilled criticism and self-criticism and purged people, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that one of the errors was that when that movement began, they took, especially among people of color, they took those of us who were the best organizers in the street and put them almost in hiding, where you were studying till your brain exploded and you were building this secret party, okay? So what happened was you lost your links. And it was amazing. If we hadn't done the work we did, you couldn't go back to people. We went back to people with these papers with language from Russia, this place. People took it because they respected the work we did. But that was a serious, grave error. African Liberation Support Committee was one of the groups that was a mass organization organizing nationally and internationally with folks, liberation forces, and they became like this and started building the party. And many of the groups, the same thing. Also, there was the sexism and the racism in the leadership of those developments, where the people who were the actors that they recruited for legitimacy were not supposed to be the theoreticians. The theoreticians were usually white men or Asian men. Okay, and some brothers, the women and the other people who did the work, y'all were the foot soldiers that went out and did the work, and we're the ones writing the treatise, we're the ones writing the paper, and we're the right ones dictating out of the air what people should be doing and not really listening to the people that were doing the work. That era, I think, still exists, and it manifests itself in many different places. So what my sister Cleo is bringing up in terms of the strength of women, because you could be in leadership now and people still expect you to wash the dishes, bring food on your shoulder, and take notes and be the secretary. That's still an issue, you know. And the other issue is people coming back that have disappeared and then reemerge on the scene, and nobody say, hey, brother and sister, where have you been all this time? And the next thing you know, they're in the movement and they're causing conflict with lots of people, and nobody's quite, they're reducing it to a personality thing, and it ain't a personality. And they should read the documents, because when you read the documents, the government's documents, you see how pervasive their invasion was in our organization. They knew all, and you people should be careful about all of what they, and I'm not trying to scare anybody. Don't, a lot of loose talk is another error. So talking about your personal business conflicts with family members, each other, is a no-no. Because later on, they use those conflicts to cause the confusion between people. Getting on the phone and announcing that you're going to do some action that you know is illegal is stupid. Right, but it's not adults, y'all, older people and younger people do it today. So it's really not understanding what the role of the state. The state is there as a terrorist organization, as brother said, to clamp down and stop any rebellion. So to go and get on the phone, put out a newspaper, arm the masses, put somebody's address on it when they're trying to organize in the street, those are all kinds of like, and different class differences. There's classes. Those of us who came from the working class background had it really behaved and acted very differently than some of the people that came from a different class background and had different goals and different objectives about why we were in the movement.
Yeah, I want to just follow on because I think we're going, absolutely, this group of people here is going, and we have political differences, so I want to make that clear. But we all know and are following along a specific line of thought, so that I want to, you know, like, make you aware of that. that internally what the government and the society does is use capitalist society sets people things up against each other. In other words, it's about the survival of the fittest. That's what they say the philosophy is. So that means that you're in competition with each other. So that means that's why there's some rich people and the rest of you poor people, you're just dumb and you're lazy. Right. But that's not true. So the whole idea of being a person that stands for change is that you are, we together can make change in society, and we can become rich because that riches and those resources don't belong to them. They've stolen them from us. Okay, so what happens is that they use all of the bad, negative, competitive aspects of society against us, number one, and then they allow us to learn those things, and we become competitive among ourselves in society, you know, in the society. So if we turn that around and become supportive and communal, then you can have your movement. So that's what they do. They spend their whole psychological profiles on trying to make trouble and to design divisions among us. Okay, all of the work that you do has to be on how to figure out how to overcome the divisions and do the right thing and unite and regain back all the resources that belong to us.
Yeah, you know, what I'm thinking about now and trying to figure out is how to stop some of the same stuff that's still happening. What Brenda said about liberalism, about the differences, it's like the movement to me has always been that we take everybody and we never throw anybody away. So anybody can come in, no matter how, wherever they are, they got antenna in their ear, they got, you know, implants, and they're talking to people, you know. You get all those people in the room together, and we didn't know how to handle it. We still don't know how to handle it, because it's still happening today. We don't value the people and the relationships. That's the most important thing. If we could value the people and the relationships, and not be liberal and try to have a balance where we have some security, because, you know, my experience with one aspect of security, which I was fortunate, I haven't gotten caught up anything at this point, is that in the Republic of New Africa, there was a person that was wound up to be an agent, and in 1971, they had a shootout at New Bethel Church in Detroit, and a cop was killed, or two cops were killed, and nobody on the Republic of New Africa was killed. A few people were wounded, and they had a trial afterwards. They had a trial, a government trial, where they accused some people of murder, and they got off. And we had an internal trial because there was a security force officer by the name of Key Farron who disappeared from his post. And he was brought up on charges, and somehow he explained it away. And then come some 10, 15 years later, Mutulu Shakur and the Brinks robbery goes down, and here you see this guy, Keith Farron, works for BOSS, the Bureau of Special Services. Now, at some point, maybe 7 years before Brinks, or sometime, my dates get mixed up, we confronted Keith. We sat down and said, you know, some people say you're an agent, because everybody was saying he's an agent. And nobody would do anything. They said, don't say anything from him, he's the agent. So some of us said, look, we got to deal with this. So we sat him down and said, people are saying you're an agent. And he said, no, I'm not no agent. And he was gone. The next day, you couldn't find him. He was gone. Just that quick. So to me, it's how we just tolerate stuff with people. We don't have all the expertise maybe to handle everything that people come and bring, and we have to do that. We also have to get tighter on criteria, meaning in the sense that, this is what I'm looking at, that people, some people are just incompetent. And they're incompetent not because they can't do the job, because we haven't given the criteria what we want people to do. So people can come in the movement and do anything or nothing, and they never get held accountable. So you can't throw them out because they did something yesterday, you know, they gave you $10, you know, but they don't do anything else. And so we don't have a criteria. We don't have, like, a job description. What are you supposed to do? And so I have that problem right now in the Republic of New Africa. You have people who supposed to be officers and supposed to be doing something, but it's no criteria, like, are you doing your job? How do we measure your performance? After 3 years of an administration, what have you accomplished? So that's why when you said the high point, what have I accomplished? What is still standing after I have given this time to this movement? There is nothing standing except people. I see children that I work with. I see people that I met. I see, you know, how they come together and they have grown. That's what I see. But there's no institution. There is no money coming in. There is no piece of land that people can go and be liberated from. So there is nothing like that. We just have people. We have better people because of this struggle. That's what we have. We have better people. And that's good because that's the most important resource. We have to have better people and so that we can have a better world. There's no way around it.
There's a lot to it, and some of the things that y'all have already spoke on. I think the question of dealing with, like, counterintelligence program and then our own internal stuff, there's so much with it. There's a lot that I learned, and I think I want to just talk a little bit about where I was at when I learned what I learned, you know, because it was during my prison time, you know. Some may say it's unfortunate, but hey, if you're sitting in the prison somewhere, you got time to reflect. You got time to think about all the stuff that has just went on, you know, and that was my place. Sundiata Kole, we would correspond, he would say, turn that prison into a university. You know, so it was not only like reading a lot of stuff, but it was like thinking about a lot of stuff, you know. But I thought about a lot of stuff real immediate, like from our BLA cell, what had just happened with this bank expropriation, to like Black Panther Party, still the chapters that were still trying to hold on in different places, to like the whole history of our struggle, our people's struggle since we done been here in this land, you know. But the psychologies, the feminisms, even the anarchist readings and stuff, it allowed me to see a lot of things different. I saw counterintelligence program. I took that and I said, okay, this is what our enemies are supposed to do. So all that, when you know, like when Masai says we need to look at their stuff, we really do. They do what they're supposed to do. Then it's like what Brenda says, you know, you got to look at what part we played in that, you know, and it's the same thing. It's like, what part did we play in that? But I focus more on personal is political. I focus so much more on that during them years in prison. I began to see that as, like, so key. Whether we're dealing with trying to, you ain't getting rid of agents, you ain't getting rid of infiltration, but you damn sure got to figure out some ways to cut down on it, you know. So one of the things that I focused on was how can we begin to change, really change who we are and our relationships with each other, you know. It even had me reading, like, Martin Luther King and stuff, you know, and things that he would say about love, but it also made me look into love more, you know. And it became more than just, like, you know, all the romantic stuff. It was like, you know, self-love. Being in a society that has ripped us from Africa, traumatic, bring us to these shores, rip everything from us, generation after generation, we are traumatized till it becomes a part of our culture. And then here comes us, the generation that seems like we're finally going to pull it together, but not enough knowing about internalized oppression or about what Fanon might say, decolonization. So I was focusing more on how do we undo so much of the good stuff that we were doing. One hand does this, the other hand just undoes all of that. How come we didn't deal with the sexism enough? How come we didn't deal with the authoritarianism enough? You know, I was like 17 years old, 18, and then there's the split in the Black Panther Party. But even leading up to the split, you know shit is going on. But I'm like, I ain't got even the personality to be able to say, yo, they just expelled Geronimo. They just expelled the Panther 21. You know, all of this stuff, something ain't right. But then you got to listen to your older comrades who say, hey, the Red Book says that ain't nobody above criticism. And Nikki was one of the main people, like, Huey Newton gets out of prison and he's making all these speeches, you know, intercommunalism and in the real intellectual language. And Nikki would say, look at him, watch him, you know, watch his behavior, look at what he's doing. And he would say, think about your principles, think about your principles. Ain't nobody above principles. And then later on, you know, like that split came to being. But I had to learn how to, like, kind of trust myself, and I needed my comrade's support for my own development.
Thank you so much for saying that, because it's just so important, this principle thing, that if everybody has the same principles, certain things that you agree, this is how you act. This is between yourselves. This is how we do. And I don't know if you noticed, but we got some principles here. Then if you have the principles, when you see people going away from the principles, then you can say, oh, wait a minute, that has to be dealt with. But if you don't have some basic principles agreed upon by everybody, that this is the principle upon which we deal with each other, and this is a principle, a fundamental set of agreements, then people can be doing anything. And you can't hold them accountable. So please design and set up what the principles are. And then everybody got to go with that, see? Or else you'll be exposed pretty openly. Everybody will know you ain't doing the right thing. You know? So
yeah. Still got interpretation. That's where the courts come in. Okay. Then you're sitting down in court. I didn't diss you, my sister. But I hear you. You're right. We have to establish some basic criteria, but it's not that easy. I haven't found it that easy. I mean, I've heard that word principle, and we talked about principles, and, you know, it's...
Well, there's some basic things like treating each other with respect and allowing dignity for each individual.
I've been married six times, you know. And I don't even understand that word respect, because women have said that. You don't
want to... spells it out for you.
That means don't come home after 10 or something, you know what I'm saying? Make sure you wash the dishes, you know, what is respect?
But the thing that I looked at in prison was that I looked at how we treated each other, you know. And I mean, I know we meant the best. I mean, the 60s was just that kind of period. We started to look at each other, you know, being black was something, it was just, it was marvelous. But like still, we still a product of this fucked up society. How are we not going to act out this stuff at the same time? So like for me to learn to read the psychologies and feminisms and a lot of other things gave me a way to see, like, we can begin to practice different behaviors, different attitudes within, you know, our movements, you know? Some people thought that, like, because I'm reading all this stuff now in prison, too, like, whoa, Shanti, what's going on with you here reading all this feminist stuff, you know? But I'm like, it was opening up my eyes to, like, you know, the male-female relationships was not that great. Mm-hmm. We meant well, but it was not that great. So, of course, COINTELPRO know all this stuff. They seeing it. They got the agents. They know who to play on. But I look for now, like, we need to, like, build good relationships. We need to learn how to love. Mm-hmm. With all the trauma we've been through, we got to figure out how to heal from, like, centuries of this kind of treatment that we've been in here. How are we going to do it? Mm-hmm. You know? And that means also developing the courage to challenge people no matter what their position is in the organization.
Well, see, I think those are two, that you're hitting on two principles. First of all, I don't think that principles are abstract. I think tapping into what you said of people coming into organizations and you don't have a job description. But there was something we learned. We were taught, give the best to the people. Mm-hmm. So whatever assignment you have, whatever, and we never saw leadership, some people did, as being elite, I'm up here, but we saw it as a certain responsibility. That's your responsibility to lead this or do X, your responsibility to do X. But all of us, whether you were the leader or not the leader, your responsibility was to give your best effort. So no one could come into the organization and you and the discipline. If you're supposed to show up at 10 o'clock and you're supposed to bring X there and you're supposed to bring leaflets, don't bring some bullshit, raggedy-ass looking leaflets that have to go out to the people. Don't show up 5 hours later. We were all supposed to be there at 10 to give the leaflets out on this corner. So there were principles about discipline, not because somebody was running an army, but because our people deserved that. The love, that's what we love. We said that transformation came through action, through doing the work, from being involved in the movement. That's how you transform. And that was through the love. You loved your people. You loved their right to be, to achieve all the things that they want. And you're going to play your role in trying to accomplish that. So those are not like abstract kinds of
things.
When
did it start becoming abstract? I mean, because, you know, all y'all got here after 1 o'clock today.
That's right.
Well,
you got a little
after one. I got here right at 1 o'clock.
So how do we get back to that a little bit more?
I think that sometimes people degenerate. Okay, and then I also think that some people have many more responsibilities than they had back then. You weren't grandmothers. You weren't trying to juggle 5 or 6 things, you know. And so, those kinds of things, but that doesn't excuse not showing up on time. But I think that also people degenerate. When you get away from, when there was like a lull in the movement, when organizations that you belonged to were destroyed, and the ones that you saw developing, you weren't too clear that you wanted to be that close up in them, then you then focus more on your own like life and your children and your other children, and you try to do what you can and stuff like that. But it's not the same, because when we were involved, some of us, I know, you were on time.
And not to put this on y'all, like what have we done? And we mean, like I'm 41 now, mm-hmm. There's people here younger than me, of course. What have we done to not keep y'all disciplined, right, if need be, and to keep out, obviously, to keep out even more importantly, right, keep ourselves? What have we not done to inspire folks, even ourselves in some ways?
There's a layer to this that is not just personal. Yes. It's also the United States' ability to bribe and distract and divert people. Mm-hmm. So, and we have this country has the best ability to do that. So this generation that we're sitting around, y'all got, based on other people's struggles, y'all were able, we didn't even think about getting into Princeton and Yale and Harvard. That wasn't even, if you're going to go to college, you either went to a local city college, community college of 4, or you went to a black college. That wasn't even on the radar screen for us. But because of the struggle, that was one of the bribes. We'll let some of them in, they want affirmative, but if you go to an elite white bourgeois college, they're going to program you to be part of their program, not part of our program. And if you go to elite black college, the same thing, going to be bribe you to be part of the black bourgeoisie that then is part of the white ruling class. So that's part of the bribe. Then the jobs. When I got out of school, I said, oh, if I could make $16,000, I thought I was going to be rich if I could just get a little job. You're all getting out of school, I'm $100,000, $300,000, $400,000, $5,000. That wasn't even the realm of possibilities. But the money was there to provide that to some of y'all. And what does that do? That gives you the option. Do I go to law school not to work in human rights, or I go to law school so I can work for the X corporation, make that big money? And as some people say, including my own daughter, said it to me one time, well, I'm going to go over there. I know it ain't right, but I'm going to put the money in the movement. You know, well, I'm going to run for office. How many black elected officials do we have? So it's so many different ways that the government was able to squash the rebellions, squash the organizations that were revolutionary in their content and their intentions, and then offer nothing in between, jail, kill, whatever, drug other people. And then when y'all came along, you had no other model except for what they were offering y'all, except for those that went back and studied or had some connections to somebody. And you had all this money, all this, quote, opportunity. So part of the lack of discipline is that there was nothing for you to be disciplined about in terms of, and there's nothing being taught in the school. History of resistance, I'm talking about, that history. Women, workers, African-American, Latinos, indigenous, which school, point out a school to me that that's a regular part of the curriculum from elementary school all up, and you're not going to find it. If you find it's a few professors here and there, a few teachers trying to do it. So you're not learning the history of resistance. You're being offered bribes. I'm not saying that y'all say, oh, this is a bribe. You're seeing it as opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. And then you see nothing as a counter in terms of organizations, except for things like Malcolm X and GAME and other groups that have really tried to keep the continuity going. So that affects discipline. That affects purpose. That affects principles. It affects a lot of things. And people saying, we don't need to do that anymore. That's played out. I don't want to hear about that. That was when y'all were way back then in the 60s. We don't. One young sister told me, she said, I don't need to go. Y'all go to rallies and stuff. I don't need to go. I could go and call my friends who are on XX board, and I could get that. So when you call them, tell them to tell the police to stop killing us. Since you've got that kind of line, that pipeline, then you call those people you know on the board and tell them to get the police to stop killing us. So is that whole, she couldn't even understand, why would somebody rally? Why would somebody march? Why would somebody take over a building? What purpose is that? And that's...
And I don't know how much it relates to some of it, but when Ashanti was talking about before, like the prison and some of the studying, I think for a lot of us, when we did go in there, that was the time to really think about even things like organizing. We went through, or at least the BLA did, went through a process called consolidation. I mean, I don't think all units of the BLA inside heard about it, might be wrong.
Most
heard about it. In consolidation, we went to things like political line, and we did think about things like security. We actually had different levels of security of who could get what information and who shouldn't get it. Part of the problem was, though, even communicating that. It was also a thing where, like, it wasn't really a voice out here. So by that point, we had already knew that we can't keep identifying above folks because they get knocked off. We knew that we needed to develop the ability to print, but we couldn't have all print interests known. But how do you, you know, articulate that out here? And at the same time, we knew that throughout the United States, I think that was one of the things that the pigs really concentrated on after the 60s and the 70s, 80s. We're not really going to know about all the rebellions happening. So it makes us think sometimes we're weak. But in prison, you get all those folks who are struggling throughout, whether they're name brand organizations or whatever, and you tend to get together. So it became dangerous when he talked about what Sundiata said about the university. It was. There was study manuals coming out. There was study sections. So you knew what they were doing in way back Georgia just as much as in New York. You knew who the people who were really doing the grassroots work. And they were all saying somewhat the same thing. But we also knew that we had some differences we had to look at. And I believe it's something that we really got to look at now. And that becomes like, for those who are conscious citizens of the Republic or consciously involved in the New African Independence Movement and those that weren't. It didn't mean that one was good and one was bad. But I mean, even when we talk about responsibility or, you know, accountability, if, in fact, I consider myself to be part of a movement for independence, I have a different structure, even militarily. I'm relating to these generals over here. If, in fact, I'm seeing myself maybe, and again, might still be BLA, but I'm more coming from a general BPP thing, well, I have a different structure over here. And it's the same thing like what we call organizing the people. For those who were relating to land, at least for many of us, we really, really saw the grassroots struggles as something that we needed to connect. But it wasn't so that we could become elected mayor of a city.
Did y'all see y'all movements as complementary or in competition sometimes?
Sometimes it was competitive and sometimes. But we all knew that we were struggling against a particular set of conditions and a particular group of people, and that eventually the bottom line is that if there's a Republic of New Africa, we could go to a brother from the Republic of New Africa and be embraced, I think. What you think?
Yeah, I think those things, were, they could
it's
be
the first time they've hugged in 35 years.
No, it's not.
I think in the beginning there was competition, just like with a lot of us. I think we was all kind of into that thing, like my organization is the right one, and you should belong to that. But circumstances kind of brought us together, you know. Especially it's just like when Cleo was talking about the relationship between Puerto Rican and Black communities in New York. You're talking about Republic of New Africa and the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army. Especially Black Liberation Army, you're talking about folks that we lived in the same neighborhoods or we fought side by side. So at a certain point, like, especially when he was talking about consolidation, it was like, there's the New African Forces and the BLA forces out of Black Panther Party. We're like together. We're like, it's, you know, like Safia Fukari and Matulu, like, are key peoples in this. You know, so there's not really a contradiction, because we see that if we're talking about self-determination, then Black people will decide what we're going to do. But if folks is fighting for land, that is definitely a legitimate struggle. So we're all going to see what we can do to help them struggles. Sundiata and them was down south setting up training camps and stuff. You know, all other kind of Republic of New Africa was doing land-based building down there. When the RNA 11...
Right, in Jackson.
And Jackson happened, the shootout down there. I mean, it was, my thing is, it was war. It was war. We saw that we was at war. And, like, we were two factions that understood that we got to prepare on all levels. So there's the above ground and there's the undergrounds, you know? And for me, it's like I still see that as important today. If I think about something like generation today need to really grasp, is that connection. Like, there has to be an underground. There, people are doing all kind of stuff above ground. I think this generation today is smarter than us, understand the connections and interconnections with all the different forms of struggles and systems, different forms of oppression and systems of control much better than we did, have much better tools to deal with internal contradictions around sexism and the homophobias and the authoritarianisms. But it's when you start looking at really challenging this system, people look at consequences.
Yeah.
Whereas us, it's just like,
we weren't scared. We were scared, but we were ready to fight.
And it's like I tell people too, like take Tariq. That's my general, right? I mean, I'm underground. We're underground. Like, Tariq is a Vietnam veteran, and he's a veteran of Brooklyn, you know? So he's a double veteran, you know? But it's, so it's like me, basically a burglar, I got guns now. I'm a little scared. But Tariq is confident. That's my comrade and my other comrades in this cell. So it made me a little bit more confident until, you know, after a number of things, and I developed the confidence. But that was the same in the Panther Party when you're doing the work. You know, it's like you gotta face some things. Some real realities is that you're going to face the most deadly empire ever. Do not think that we're getting out of this without more deaths, more political prisoners, but also with more of them going down too at some point. And we better develop the capacity to do it. But we have to build community. We have to build communities amongst ourselves for that to happen.
But there was models. I mean, that was a time where you saw yourself as a professional revolutionary. It wasn't even a question. So it was any means necessary. Was not just a model. And why? Because you saw people fighting all around the world and winning. Mm-hmm. You saw women in Mozambique and Frelimo with weapons fighting right alongside of their men. And you were in contact with them. It wasn't like you didn't know these people. You met with the people from all those different countries. You met with the Vietnamese. It was everybody around the world at that time. So then y'all don't have that now. I mean, you see the reaction and you're getting the results of the reaction and the beat back. But now there is a rising up. Now people are taking back land all around the world. People are taking back buildings. People are taking over factories. So the thing is to plug into that tempo. But it was just like an explosion. So you didn't, it's not like we were foolish. Some people were adventurous and I wonder who some of those people were. But I mean, most of us, seriously, we didn't think about careers. If those of us who were in college dropped out.
That's right.
And went and worked in the factories or did what you were supposed to do in the community. The ones that stayed in college had a particular task to do, and it was for the movement. You didn't sit, when somebody said, well, what did you want to be? I didn't have a career model. I wasn't like, oh, I want to be X, I'm going to go work here. I want to see that my people are free. And this is not bullshit. And that's how people thought. So when you were working in the community, these brothers and stuff that took the weight for us because they really believed in what they were doing. They really believed in it. Now, some people might have betrayed some of that, and that's why y'all wound up where you were, or we made some errors, and that's why we wound up where we were. People got, if you take a stand, that's why the word, I don't want to be the word struggle means struggle. Mm-hmm. You ain't going to drop a drop of water in something and the movement's going to pop up. You're not going to put it in the microwave and it come back. Or you do very little and wait for your friends to go do much. But that's not just y'all. That's everybody. If you're in a trade union place, you go ahead and talk to the boss. Come back and tell me what happened. I don't have time to come to the meeting because I'm scrubbing my floor, washing my clothes today. So it's everywhere. But in the 60s, you began to see a groundswell that people, even if they said, I'm not going to say, everybody would say that they were a Panther. And you know that half of those people weren't Panthers. Right? So everybody would say they were part, they wanted to identify with that energy and what you believed in at the time.
I think we're taking up too much time among this discussion.
That's the point.
Yeah, go ahead. Talk.
Okay. Because so, I want to get this dialogue. Oh, was you getting ready to say that?
No, go ahead. Do you have something you want to say?
One more thing.
Go ahead.
All right. And that is that those of us who was revolutionary, that had committed ourselves, that we ain't going to do nothing else in life but change things for the better for our people, we also admired those that came before us, and we would sit at their feet, and we would also want to fight to avenge what happened to our people before. It was to avenge what happened in slavery. It was to avenge all the lynchings. It was to avenge, and right now it should be to avenge what's happening to our political prisoners, but to free them. But it was to avenge those things and to bring us back to humanity because of the horrible things that happened to our people. You know what I'm saying? So that's a real important point, is that recognizing the people that came before you, that gave their lives and struggled, and giving them, you know, their propers, and recognize and fighting for their freedom, fighting for Sister Sada, Sundiata Kohli, and Mutulu Shakur, some of the people that, and Mumia Abu-Jamal, and people that we, you know, that gave their lives for us to be able to sit here and do this. So that's it.
Yeah, I may be off the point. I'm going back to two points you made about, you said, what should this generation, you know, do to make us, keep us on point.
So, I mean, maybe that's a good point. Let's turn our chairs around.
Yeah, thank you.
And start the dialogue with the larger group.
Can I say one more thing, though?
No.
Okay.
After you turn your chair around.
Yeah,
all right.
Chair around.
Oh, well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Y'all going to be facing out. Yeah, okay. You're going to turn your chair around.
I'm not going to see you.
I want to change seats now, because I've been...
Okay, these are the people.
Okay. No.
This is y'all's process, not ours. Okay. We would have been sitting among y'all.
Y'all good?
Go ahead.
Yes.
You want to
say? Give him some more water.
Oh, you a special water person? Oh, I didn't know that. I want to touch the water.
Say, could need some more
no,
water.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Do you really or no?
No, I'm all right.
So we're gonna start the dialogue part with everybody sort of contributing and talking. And the way we want to try to get this structured is that you're having conversation with these folks, right? So I'm going to try to do as little moderating as possible, but I also like to talk, so I'll probably jump in if somebody else is talking too long, right? So y'all have to excuse me if I do that. But I wanted to sort of start off with Sekou. We're going to start off with a point of...
What?
Good.
The point I was thinking, you were saying, what can this organization, organizations of this generation do to keep us or me as a old head on point.
What do you expect out of this generation too? Mix that in. You gotta expect something. So mix that in there. But go ahead, brother.
All right. It's employing us, you know, giving us some work to do. You know, this here forum is one way, you know, you invite us here and we come and we talk, and so we have to be on time, we have to be on point, gotta, you know, wear our shoes and stuff like that, and get out the house. And so, to me, it's institutions are the only thing that they're gonna give us work. It's gonna keep us going. I in the Republic of New Africa, I remember the old people, the elders. You know, they were involved. You know, Queen Mother Moore was an elder who had an office. She was an officer, and she was there at the meetings, and so you could talk to her. Papa Wells was another elder who was there for old Garveyites, old nationalists, and they were there, and you could talk to them. They would come to the meetings because there was a structure that had meetings, that had work to be done, and so the people could tap into it. So I must tap into something, or you must tap me into some kind of structure. So you have to create something to keep it going. You just can't dissipate because then, you know, I can't catch you. I'm not held responsible. So maybe that's what I expect. My pet peeve is building institutions. There is nothing standing for us. We have not given you anything that you can run, or we can hand over the keys of the city to you, so to speak, Sante. So I just say we have to create institutions, and the interesting thing was the thing was about competition, but I'm going to hold that. The point Sister Brenda mentioned was just talking about flyers. You know, she was saying that you can't have, you know, sloppy flyers. And to me, I look at the movement and I measure the quality of this here activist movement or nationalist movement by the quality of the flyers. I mean, they're sloppy except for MXG. They have some great quality stuff. I'm telling you, I've said that. I've said that to them. You know, and that's what you have to produce. We talk about we produce the best work, but look at the flyers in the nationalist community and you look at the quality. Look at them. You'll see typos. You'll see, you know, it's just shoddy stuff in the age of, you know, whatever, page, you know, spell check and all the other stuff they got. You know? And so that to me says something about where, you know, where we are with quality, where we are with our commitment, if our work or the stuff we give to people and want them to come in doesn't represent exactly what we're building. It's not that light set on a hill. Okay? So that's it. Thank you.
Anybody else have expectations that they feel that a younger generation should have towards them and vice versa?
Kind of a quick thing on that is it. Okay, my thing is that if somebody doesn't say that they're part of what I'm a part of, then it's like I don't disregard them, but I can't expect certain things from them. You know, like we talk about a light up on the hill. That's coming from those who relate to the Republic of New Africa. But if somebody else goals objective to be something else, then I can't expect them to understand that. And again, because they got different goals and objectives, it's what they may be motivating for is the way I'm going. And I do think that some of us, in my generation or whatever, we have an obligation, or we had an obligation to pass on and develop ways to pass on what we're talking about. The institutions that Sekou is talking about, we still don't have them within the PG, I mean, or within the independence movement. But that ain't something on everybody else. It's like, why haven't we developed what we need to be an example for folks before young folks even think about coming over as they used to? I mean, we got it. Now, MXG becomes something different. I look for something from MXG because they profess to relate and they flow from the New African Independence, line. So it's like if I talk to somebody from MXG and I talk about the five states and they, you know, talk about Canada and Mexico, then I know that I haven't done what I should be doing and they haven't been doing. In the early days, I used to talk to folks from MXG and they had not a clue what the five states were. You know, but that's a different expectation. And can I say something else that was related to what I was thinking before? We talk about self-determination, we talk about nations, whatever, and a lot of ways we're talking about anti-imperialism. And I do think one of the things that's happening now is that a lot of folks, when they talk about even the movement now, this is more like what they call a global thing. But as far as relating other folks based on anti-imperialist politics, no. And we did do that. Mm-hmm. So it's like the BLA could talk to other armed formations because we were talking about people really at war. We were talking about the Puerto Rican independence movement, the Chicano movement, you know. Those were real movements. But it was also those white folks that was involved, those who stuck around, with those anti-imperialists. We find that a lot of white folks now don't know them. So the line they're following is either no line at all or a lost line. instead of for what to us would be the line, they should be following those lines that flow from those white anti-imperialists. Not only should they be following them, we also think that people need to remember them because they need to be supporting them. Support them, know where they come from, and it might be better and easier for you to understand where some of us are coming from.
Y'all got things
to say? This is a question for the sisters. I wanted to know. Hello. Hi, my name is Wendy. I wanted to know, how did you deal with the sexism that was going on in that era? Or if you dealt with that at all, and, like, you know, what ways you used to overcome that?
Can I answer? Brenda, can I go first?
Sure.
A lot of people ask me this question, and there's a couple of things that was going on. In the Black Panther Party in particular, there were two schools of thought among the sisters, pretty much. And there was one school of thought, and that was just a part of the society, was that there's some bad, fine brothers in the Black Panther Party. I want to get in there and get with one of them or a bunch of them. Okay? So, but that was just a part of what was going on in society. And these were, I mean, not only they were dynamic, they weren't scared, they was the baddest brothers in the society. And everybody wanted to get with that. There was also the school of thought is that I'm a revolutionary just like the brothers are, and I want to be recognized and respected and equal to you. So I was in that group of people. I was as bad as any brother. I had a green belt in karate. I could run faster and faster. I sold more newspapers. I did all the things, the physical things that the brothers did too. And so I gained the respect of the brothers, and the other claim to fame that I have that I think is important is that I never slept with a brother in the Black Panther Party or the Young Lords for the whole time. This stuff,
oh, that was a key thing.
So that
to have a revolutionary
baby. The brothers could relate to me as another revolutionary, not as a sex object. Okay? But I understand that there's confusion and conflict. You know, this is not that easy to flesh out, you know, because of how relationships go. And that there was a lot of relationships and there were a lot of different philosophies internally in the organization. The point is that women in the party did demand that we be treated as equals, and in many instances, particularly in the Harlem branch, which is my experience, where my experience was that women ran the party. They just directed who was to go where, sell newspapers. They decided who was going to organize and which kind of, whether you're going to do housing organizing or healthcare organizing, or you're going to work on a free breakfast program. The sisters was the officer of the day in the office. And that means the officer of the day organizes and tells everybody where they got to be and what, okay, and what's going on. So that's...
I would just...
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I have another question now. So he was saying, like, you know, the sisters, like, sometimes they were running. So was it kind of like just something that happened, or was it addressed? Like, all right, sexism is going on within the organization. How are we going to combat this? That's one. And then two, my other question is, you said, like, you know, about the whole sleeping thing, that you never slept with a brother. Well, let's say that, you know, one of the sisters would have slept with a brother. And, you know, you were implying, like, about the whole respect thing, that, like, respect is lost. Because that's an issue in and of itself. So that's why I'm wondering, was there, like, a, you know, a space where that could be addressed?
Yes. There was a space, and the brothers did deal with questions of sexism and did try to struggle with them, but the sisters also had meetings and discussions among ourselves, too. And that's very important for the sisters to talk among themselves and for the brothers to deal with it, too.
But there also, I mean, in within particularly in all the organizations I was in, but particularly the new left formations, there was a concerted effort to combat both the racism and the elitism and the sexism, and concretely. So there were groups that women had to be able to be trained that didn't know how to do it to write articles. Women were going to speak. Women were going to lead, you know, commissions or other groupings. They were going to, and you were going to respect them. And if you didn't, you were going to be called on it that's what the whole criticism, self-criticism, like some of it was good and some of it went overboard. But it was really tackled. And there were, other thing was just the prank. When people are predators, it doesn't matter if they're in the movement or not. Malcolm X University, there was a setup where they recruited a lot of very, very, very young sisters. And they promoted the idea that you, part of your contribution was to produce revolutionary babies. I'm just holding them up as an example because that's a bad example, and that it didn't just happen with them. So it's also being able to have self-respect. Some of the women came from mothers and grandmothers and aunties that didn't take that shit in the house or in the community, and they modeled examples of being activists. So if you came in with that and you mingled with other sisters who maybe didn't have that experience, that co-mingling together helped generate that. And plus, again, around the world, you saw the sisters in Philema and the sisters and of the among the Viet Cong and other sisters of the way, they were equal. They were, and they still have struggles now in terms of, going back and retracing. So it's a recognizing it, setting up a plan, and tackling it.
I have a question for Ashanti Masai Sekou, sort of related to that question. And I wanted to know what advice you would give as elders to the younger generation of black men who consider themselves to be revolutionary, but might be following in the footsteps of what they assume to be the right way to go about dealing with women in the movement. I think that there was some work done around like sexism, during the 60s.
Most definitely.
But I think that generally the legacy that people feel like has been passed on is one of sexism. I know that a lot of young brothers who are coming up and that think that that's the right way to go. So I wanted to know what you, as elder men, what advice you would give to young men as far as addressing sexism and patriarchy.
Oh yeah, I'm Sekou. I was thinking about that sexism. I cannot recall myself being in a nationalist meeting talking about that. I mean, but that might be my sexism. I just don't remember. What I would say to men, I guess to me, the thing would be that we need to marry the women. I mean, we need to not have perennial relationships or sexual triad. We just need to think about looking early, because I didn't do that early. I didn't say, I'm going to look at somebody to be a wife, to create a family. That's what I would say is my advice. I tell men that now, that you should get married and you should look at a woman to be your wife and to raise your children and family. I maintain that you work a lot better when you have that. In my experience, I'm sorry. It might be. It might be. I'm just telling you. I'm saying when. That's how I feel. I feel that I work better. I feel that people work better, the organizations work better when that sexual tension is not there, because that sexual tension is there. I don't see it disappear. I don't see how you can discuss it that people are not going to want to get in somebody's pants or have sex. And so,
it's not going to disappear.
Well, I mean, maybe it won't, but maybe that deals with measuring people's commitment, because now you have a criteria. If somebody's married and still running around, then you have a criteria. They have to. That's the best I can say, unless somebody else has the answer to give me, because I sure would like to hear it.
You been doing all the reading, brother, so you got to impart that knowledge.
I just want to hear.
Teach me. Listen, family. first thing we got to understand is that we are a family, and there's going to be diverse opinions coming out of this. And one of the reasons why you need to hear diverse opinions is because you need to make up your minds about what you get from our experiences. All right, I'm happen to be one that is very much non-monogamous, right? I found some things that the thing in the Black Panther Party when we was talking about free love or socialist fucking, right? I thought that was a great thing, even though I was too shy to participate. Because I understood the Black Panther Party trying to break down some bougie relationships. Relationships that we have been raised on, to challenge people to say there's other ways that we can relate to each other, as long as there's respect, there's a mutual agreement that folks want to get together, and you ain't messing with someone else's wife or someone else's acknowledged partner. Reading in prison, back to the prison thing again, reading about sexism, feminism, and all this other different stuff, you know, I realized that, you know, the sexism in the Panther Party, I mean, we tried to deal with it. There was a policy on it, you know.
Yeah.
But now you're talking about culture. This is the most sexist culture you can come out of. We got all of that in us. If you don't have things in place within your revolutionary organization that's going to get into you internally to deal with your sexism, you're going to act it out, you know. Elders used to talk about the super masculine menial and the ultra feminine something, right? But part of it was to say that, you know, we act out these roles, and just because you take on a revolutionary ideology don't mean that, you know, you all of a sudden going to be this new human being. Mm-hmm. That's a real difficult
struggle. The new man and the woman.
The thing that I learned, and I have said it even in my talks, is that dealing with sexism for men is a very scary thing. It is much easier to be a macho man in the revolution. I would rather do bank expropriations than to deal with sexism, because it touches some shit in me that I don't want to deal with, right? But if you're going to create different relationships, free relationships, men must challenge their sexism. One of the things that keeps me encouraged about young people today is that you have a much better understanding of that than we did. I come into like the anarchist circles, and they would have a thing in there where it was like said to the men, you gotta learn to step back, you gotta learn to shut up, you gotta learn to mind your man tones. That was all different stuff, because we realized how destructive it can be. But I'm one that's in favor of, even in a revolutionary group, there should be some freedoms to relate even sexually, as long as you're learning about what you're doing. It is a part of who you are. It is part of the stuff of life. If it doesn't destroy the unity of the group. But you got to have things in place. You got to have some ways to, like, really be able to talk. Men need to have men groups constantly. Don't give me your fingers, man. I'm on the road. And I will. But men need to have men's groups that don't get intellectual, but that we really get to what we're so scared of, in terms of just being human beings and seeing women, as human beings, and not as sex objects, or trying to get with the prettiest one in your eyesight within the group. Who can you fuck? Because all that stuff happens within revolutionary groups too. But it is a corrosive, like we used to say with in the Red Book, the points of liberalism. It's a corrosive that eats away at unity. We got to confront that stuff.
Okay, this question is for Sister Belinda.
Brenda,
excuse me.
That's okay.
And then for everyone else, if they want to answer, you were talking a little bit about the conditions that are needed. And, you know, when I first started really learning about the 60s and learning about what was going on and the world conditions and those connections that you were speaking about, it was put to me as though our job in this time is to create those conditions, right? How do you see creating those conditions, and how are those conditions being created that could start a movement, you know, or start a more revolutionary movement that you guys have experienced?
It's maybe it's just the word. It's not like you create a movement, it's that you build a movement. Because you actually are doing the work. So, for example, we didn't create the atmosphere. It's because people, it was like a critical mass most things happen when a critical mass occurs where everybody's on the same page. So, for example, critical mass when the welfare mother said, I'm not taking this shit anymore. We're going to change the welfare system. A critical mass is when a majority of the tenants or a critical group of them say, I'm not going to take not having hot water and heat. So for some, and then you know about it. You know that other people are doing stuff too. And so you see I'm part of a larger picture of people who are standing up righteously. So it's not like, I guess, I don't know, I'm just, I know I'm trying to find out where our commonality in terms of the word. And I think when you say create, it's almost like somebody comes, sits down and crafts something rather than engaging, being involved, becoming, it's like all those things, you become conscious. How do you become conscious? How can I tell him what his limit is in the workplace versus mine, right? You know, so my, but he gets fed up and then he comes and talks to me and taps something in me. And I'm saying, yeah, you're right. He did such and such to me, the same thing in the workplace. And he says, he's at a different place. He said, well, I'm ready to do something about it. Then we go around and we talk to other people. So it's like a process. It's like a development, but it's an engagement of people who are conscious on whatever level they're conscious. And then the study, we were talking about what people, what I expect. What I expect is more what I want for you. I want you to be the best revolutionaries you can, meaning that I want you to be the best informed. I want you to be the most united. I want you to learn from our failures. That's what I want. Anything that we did that was wrong, and it's not like bowing down. The brother, you were talking about people sitting at people's feet. It wasn't like we felt that the elders were all perfect and all knowing. It was that we honored the fact that they did. They stood up righteously and fought, and they're still here to tell us something that we can learn from. I still talk to my elders now. I value their experience because I wasn't living then, and I didn't do what you did. So I have to have, you have to have something that I can learn from. So I just hope that you honor the past history of resistance, and if there are any fighters still standing and their brain cells are still working, that you connect with them, but more important, that you build the baddest, biggest international movement that will kick the ass of this country and all the other countries that want it. That's what I want for y'all.
Thank you.
You know, and we can't, we'll be here as long as we can, even with crutches and canes and walkers. Anything that we could contribute, we'll try to contribute. But we were not perfect. We just had this, I don't know, it was like an infection. It was like everybody was infected to go. And I want that moment, and I feel that it's coming. When we did the discussion with Picture the Homeless, I found for myself this thing that said no trespassing. And what was it? It was a chapter that accumulated all the struggles of takeovers of lands and buildings. And I got inspired from reading that. I got inspired because I said, oh, you're not going to find that in the Post and the Times. But somebody took the time to pull that together, and immediately I said, here, y'all take this, because that's what y'all are trying to do. You need to know other people are doing it. So it's finding the connections. Sorry.
Yeah. So I guess so from your knowledge, and this is for everyone, what are the movements and certain and conditions and you know, like kind of uprisings from Latin America to around the world to in this country that you see coming together as a strategic path to, you know, create those kind of connections that would help to build that stronger international and, you know, nationalist movement that are, you know, what are those factions, what are those groups, what are those, you know, independence movements or uprisings that are going on currently that we should know about?
Okay, I'm going to try to be really fast, but one of the things that's happening now is that there is a growing set of conditions in the society on which, if you study the society, that's why study becomes such a key thing, is that the economic conditions now, where people are losing their jobs and that there's homelessness, that this is the conditions that create upheaval.
Uh-huh.
Because people want to fight back. Nobody wants to be homeless. Nobody wants to lose a job. There should never be 50% black male unemployment. That is something that, if you know that that exists and you know that there's 50% of black males are on the street, that's a place where you can go and begin a struggle. That's very specific. And the economic, being a part of the economic struggle, the struggle about finance, takes you to internationally connect with the workers in other countries that's fighting over the same issues, which is joblessness, homelessness, and better economic conditions.
Are there countries in particular that you see?
Well, definitely in Africa. All the countries in Africa are faced with total devastation. Women in Nigeria take off their clothes to demand about oil. That's all financial, economics. Those women, you want to build relationships with them and find out what they're doing, what's happening there. Workers, immigrant workers from all the different countries, you know, but you got to study. In order to find these things out, you got to study and be fully aware of what's going on in the society.
And I would say, like, I'm thinking it still goes back to what is it that you think you want to do. You got to tap into something. Otherwise, there's nothing I can tell you that you could really identify with, because I don't know where you want to go. And I think sometimes, folks, now we tend to, there's a thing about going back to a day that never was. Even when we talk about the 60s, 70s, or 80s, I mean, it wasn't like this perfect all unity. It was a spirit of resistance, and it was learning and struggling. But it wasn't no perfect day for folks to go back to. And like I said, it's a whole lot about what you want to get into and what you go to, and this kind of taps on with the previous question about even like the sexism, if I can go back to it, instead of escaping. See, I'm a Muslim, so I was listening when Sekou answered. His answer focuses on marriage. Within the RNA, the family is the basic unit of organization. And as a Muslim, like marriage plays a role, but we also understand that that's not the way everybody sees it. We know that there is sexism. Is there sexism in Islam? Yeah, but the way that that's dealt with is different than maybe among other folks. And we do think it needs to be dealt with, but again, these are things that came up for some of us inside the prisons. This is what a large number of RNA citizens are, a large number of blah folks are. But we know everybody is. So the question can't really be thrown out there. And we shouldn't really just accept an answer that we get as being, you know, the good answer, because it still means we got to do some research, and we do have to learn to get along with each other to a certain extent, even though recognizing the difference. I usually like to let sisters answer that question. A Muslim, a Muslima, to answer that question, because she can explain it both as a sister and at the same time as a Muslim.
Yes, Uhuru. My name is Nkululeko, and I'm the president of the Queens branch of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. MPDOM is a mass organization that's geared towards defending the democratic rights of the black community with the understanding that self-determination is the highest expression of democracy. MPDOM was created by the African People's Socialist Party, which is a revolutionary political party of the African working class. And we understand that, you know, our primary condition is our relationship, you know, our primary contradiction is our relationship to the white ruling class. So everything that, like, we're speaking our enemy's language right now. We're speaking English. And that's to say that we are colonized, and that we take on the tendencies of colonialism. And patriarchy is a tendency of colonialism. So I think if you want to enter into this revolutionary process, I think that should be a point on the platform to help you deal with the tendencies of colonialism. The platform should help you understand the conditions that we are in. And like you said before, we can't be liberal. We got to deal with criticism and self-criticism to help us, you know what I'm saying, eliminate the tendencies of colonialism so that we can be better revolutionaries. I personally feel that the conditions are ripe for revolution. I look at the world, I see a spiraling economy, inflation, high unemployment. I see, you know, people in Venezuela forming a bloc, and South America forming a bloc against U.S. imperialism, and I see mass resistance in Africa. When I look at myself, what is my role in the belly of the beast in the so-called world capital? My role is to build this movement. My role is to, I'm saying, to go to my brother to my left, my sister to my right, or wherever they may be, and say, I know you see that we don't got no curriculum inside the schools. I know you see that they're not educating us. I know you see the police are standing army in our hood. What are we going to do about it, comrade? What are we going to do about it, brother? What are we going to do about it, sister? Let's build this movement. Let's build this committee. Let's get organized so that we can mobilize. And I can email your flyer. They're going to say, so you can see that Uhuru MPDOM is the organization to be dealt with. And I also want to respect and big up this whole forum right here, this intergenerational discussion, dialogue, because this is that mass movement that needs to be created so that we can complete this movement. I mean, I just see it as a continuation. I'm here to complete to continue and complete the Black Power movement. That's saying one Africa, one nation.
I have two questions for everyone. The first one is, I mean, maybe more specifically to folks that were part of the RNA and the Black Panther Party. I find out that within nationalist circles, the competition piece, whether folks intrinsically say it or whether they're saying it like internally within their own formation or outside of their formation in terms of how do folks actually come together when we are doing the same levels of work. And so I was just wondering, my first question was just sort of, how did the Black Panther Party and RNA back then sort of deal with, of course, the understanding that we have ideological differences to move forward? That's my first question. But I mean, now y'all are all thinking that's all. Sort of when folks is really struggling. And then my second question is specifically, again, most folks sitting here come out of Black nationalist circles. I just wanted to know folks' ideas, thoughts, and contradictions about formations with the white left. Because I think that is something that as nationalist formations are coming through now, just how folks dealt with it then, just maybe some ideas for how we deal with it now. Because I know a lot of nationalist circles get the white left that want them to participate in their own communities with them, and sort of contradictions in how to deal with that. So those are kind of my two questions. Open frame.
When you finish with them, I would like to respond to the thing about the white left.
Yeah, thanks a little bit. That competition thing, I don't know if I understand it how you mean it, but it came up before. And to me, I always see that all our organizations are in competition with each other. I mean, we are working to get people, and we have our different belief systems, ideologies, and we are recruiting people to be in there. So to me, as long as we have our separate groups, groupings, there's always going to be some competition in the sense that we want people, you know, I want people to come into the Republic of New Africa and work and do that type of work. I don't know if to me, I never felt there was any big fighting between Black Panther Party and the PG in the sense that we all kind of just worked together, as I remember, you know, the members of the party I work with. I mean, generally, when the Panther Party came to New York, to South Jamaica, they came into the office that Herman Ferguson had when he was running for senator of New York State in 1968. Okay, and that was just a little after Republic of New Africa came into existence in 1968. And so the Panthers came into that. We all kind of worked together. But there's always competition. There's always generally, you know, it's not talked about. It's not like we sit down and say, how are we going to pull these people from this other structure? I just see that some of that is exhibited in the whole concept of united fronts. You know, I don't see them working that well, but they still come together because nobody wants to dissolve their boundaries, you know, and so we come together as united front. So, that's my take on it.
Yeah, I would say, like, see, for a lot of us, the way we see the Republic of New Africa, that's the name of a nation of people. And it's a nation that has many different organizations. So in some areas, maybe they are in competition, but it should be how they can best serve the people. But you might have a New African Women's Organization. You have a collective like I was a part of, Spear and Shield Collective. That was an organization of New African Captive Combatants. But we all considered ourselves to be part of the Republic of New Africa. And then when Sekou talked about the chapter or the party over there, like in Queens, you might have had a lot of folks there who already were nationalists. You might have had some other places where people were Panther members and maybe was a little bit more into something else. And it took a while. And then just finally, like on that thing, like the relationship with the white left, like I said, my thing is that, you know, relate to anti-imperialists on another level. Now, can relate to all white folks in many ways the same as anybody else in certain ways. But as far as where we would think, like, you know, people's heart would be at and those who might be the most committed to the struggle for independence, it would be anti-imperialists. Which...
Yeah, I think that in order to really, first of all, organizations are a tactical question. They're not created to last for eternity. They're supposed to serve a particular purpose. And once that purpose has been met or they were not capable of meeting it, then it needs to dissolve. So some of it is ego, where people create organization, the competition, and they want to keep their organization so they can still have something to say, this is my base and I'm the leader, when the organization in itself doesn't really need to exist or should have stopped existing a long time ago. That's one issue. But in terms of the white left, part of the process that went on, I guess you could say the 70s, was it the 70s of trying to build a new party, the party of a new type was the yeah. phrase. That, like I said, they started out as national-specific study groups in some cases, or groups based in workplaces. And of course, there was the white left that existed. You know, there was those that weren't in the CP, but like an October League and some of the other groups. And there were meetings going on trying to merge all the groups together into one party, because nobody thought we could defeat this monster with 1,000 little parties, but it had to be one. So the whole question of whites' relationship in our communities came up from the onset. It also came up when the Black United Front was formed, and there were whites who wanted to support, and it's come and it's today. I'm not speaking for any other group. This is my philosophy. The issue of racism is so ingrained in this country that there's so much work for the white left to do in their own communities to win over their own. That's who I respect. I respect the whites who are really respected in their community, not seen as some weirdos there, and they have respect because they're doing work and they're also changing people's minds and they're having them concretely support the struggle of the oppressed. I resent the white left who sets up an office in Harlem. Okay. I resent the white left who comes and has rallies only in Harlem and Bed-Stuy and black areas but won't have them in their own community. And I resent them standing on the corner selling papers to us like we're stupid and they're there to enlighten us. I work in multinational groups. I work in all black groups and I work in multinational groups. But people are real clear that when I and other blacks work in that group that you got to deal with your racism and the sexism. And they do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be even near you. Right? And what the way it's manifest is not like this liberal bullshit of trying to always act like black people are always correct and they always have all the knowledge and, you know, they're catering to you when you know it's all phony, but actually the principles. Is it do you have an anti-pillage position? Are you doing work in your own community? Are you supporting the right issues? And if our community needs something, just like you want us to show up, will you? We don't have sound. You got sound? You don't need to come, but you can give us the sound. And that's not, and I don't mean, because there was an aspect of our movement where people used white people, and I'm not promoting that, and then said that they were comrades. Somebody can't be a comrade if you're using them, and they're using you. But it's sharing as resources, and you know how you were able to accumulate this stuff, and we weren't able to accumulate it. So while we're trying to get our act together and get it, you got it, we need it. But we don't need you to come and tell us how to run a rally.
So we're going to, now we'll take some more audience participation. We're going to wrap up soon. Okay, my question for you, you say, define your enemy and how does your enemy hold you back from what you're doing, and given that English is the enemy's language, if you speak another language, what advantage do you have over those who only speak that particular language, and if you speak another language, have you made a connection with that particular group to make
the point you're
trying to
do? Well, my point was that, you know, we have been colonized. Our actions, the way we think, you know, is affected by how we act. You know, we have been taught by our enemies, the ones who enslaved us, be it the French, be it the Spanish, the Portuguese, or the English. We've taken on their customs, and we treat each other the way that they taught us to treat each other. And we see ourselves in their... You know, how they pictured us, that's how we
identify. As the colonial,
let
him
do the
ahead.
Answer thing.
And, yeah, I've taken initiative to probably learn some Creole, some Swahili and things of that sort, some Spanish, so I can go communicate with the working class peoples over there and relate their conditions to how what's going on in my hood right here in New York. You know what I'm saying? Based upon our commonalities, we can organize to address, attack our common enemy. Who is my enemy? The white ruling class. Who is their cohorts? The black petty bourgeoisie. And I'm for the working people. I'm for the poor and oppressed, you know?
And I feel like, you know, when I become one nation, it's my nation.
I understand that. But you also mentioned that the Spanish were also the people who were also in part to the colonizers. You also put blame also on the Spanish, but you just said that you want to learn Spanish too. How is that different from learning another enemy language than the one you speak?
Are you just trying to disprove me or something? I speak English. This is the language I was born in America as a result of slavery and colonization. But I was born in Brazil, I'll be speaking Portuguese or Spanish because of the same reason. And I go to those places and organize people around the class contradictions, you know, saying the work class of people's contradictions, be it schools, housing, you know, police brutality, or what have you, and be able to use our commonalities to address, you know what I mean, the fundamental contradiction being, you know, imperialism, you know.
We're going to take 3 or 4 more. We're going to wrap up soon.
I've got his hand up.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
I want to follow up.
Maybe like.
Is this
problem? Okay. He had
it
set up for a while,
though,
so I'm just
going to
let him do it.
So first, I'm Rob from Picture the Homeless, and I'm going to address the group with some humor, a statement, and then a question. First of all, one of the things Richard Pryor always said is, you don't get to be old being a fool. And there's a lot of young wise men, and they're deader than young. It's one of the strongest things that I think he's ever said. That being said, you challenge us with knowing the 5 states. I don't particularly know them. And there may be other people in this room that don't know them. So I'm going to say, what are you going to do to educate us on what those 5 states are? But I'm going to say, personally, I know I could leave this room because I have a relationship, something that I built learning this stuff real quick through Brenda Stokely. I know by the time I get outside on the street, I'm going to dial a certain number, and I'm going to find out what those 5 states are. But everybody's not that fortunate to have that relationship like I do in this room. So as the old heads, the knowledgeable folks, what are you guys going to do to develop a forum and put, you know, be able to teach us? And I'm not so young. I'm somewhere between you guys and Kamal, so, you know, but there's a lot of young folks in this room that can do
that. It wasn't a completely rhetorical question, but I'm going to ask you guys to answer that more in your wrap-up because I'm getting more stuff on the table. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We're going to go around. I'm doing my best. Take it to the best spirit. Okay.
I'm going to stand up because I was taught that you should stand up when you talk in a crowd. First of all, I just want to thank you for, you know, contributing your words and your wisdom, taking the time to come out here and talk to everybody. And I wanted to share a quick, short story that relates a little bit to what we're talking about here today. The story takes place in Chiapas, in the south of Mexico. In Chiapas, like in a lot of places all around Latin America, the indigenous people are organizing and talking to one another in order to survive, you know, in order to get by and to see a future. So there is a journalist from the United States, from New York, that went to one of the meetings that the people in San Cristobal were having. And the guy got in a little bit late, you know. All of a sudden he realized the meeting wasn't in Spanish or in English or any language he could recognize. It was in Tzotzil. And so he kept on listening. And there's one word that the people kept on repeating. It was something like chip, chip, chip. And he had no idea what that word was. He kept on listening. He heard that word over and over again. It kind of reminded him of how the rain sounds when it hits the top of the rooftops in Chiapas, because the rooftops are made out of tin. So he kept on hearing, cha, cha, cha. And so automatically, since he's from New York and he speaks English, he's from the United States, he assumed that the word cha meant I, which is the most often used word in English, I. Eventually, he found out that in Chiapas, the word cha means we.
We.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is great. This meeting is good because this is understanding who we are, and this is the only way that we're going to understand what the disease is, and through the disease is the only way we're going to understand how to find the cure. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Did you have
a hand?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm from South Asia, from India, and growing up, my parents were like my parents lived under martial law, our house was bombed, and my mom was pregnant with me. And so, and growing up, I heard a lot of stories about South Asian struggles with independence. And when I finally went back to India, I had this really interesting revelation. It's kind of my question to everyone in this room. It's like, because what happened with South Asia is they won, you know, like they got the revolution. But, and because of, but through that, there was also such a split, and there was so much more damage. And now these people who won their rights and their movements are now oppressing other people. So if we win, if anyone here of any race, color, or identity, if we win, how do we not oppress? Like, how do we avoid oppressing? Because that's something that is what India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, all of them are now dealing with. And it's really, really difficult for them to get out of that mentality to be like, we are doing to others what's been done to us.
Well, your movement wasn't won in the absence of still imperialism existing. Your movement was not won in India or any place else in the world without imperialism still existing and still wanting to maintain a foothold or regain a foothold. So when I was talking earlier about how the United States, for example, to bribe, the same thing in terms of the imperialist countries collectively can bribe people inside your movement to be able to betray what the objectives of the movement. That's one piece. The second piece is that the movement isn't the people who get in leadership of the government. One of the things that I learned both going to Cuba and Venezuela, it was reinforced rather than really learned, was that the message that people would run up to tell you is that Chavez is not the revolution, we are. And they demonstrated by showing us what they were doing and how they were making decisions. And the same thing in Cuba. So anyone who thinks that once you win that phase of the movement, and then that's the end, and then somehow we're going to go through la-la land afterwards and everything's going to be perfect, is really someone or people or a movement that's not really understanding the forces around them, because every movement has been betrayed by those same forces, whether it was all the African liberation moves, whether it was Russia, China, whatever. The imperialist forces got a foothold.
Can I just say real quick, it's that the whole goal of revolution is to end exploitation of one human being over another.
Exactly.
So you know that we have not won unless we are in the process of and in ending the exploitation of one group or one group of people over another group of people. We want everyone to be free.
Who has questions still raising hands? Hand raised.
You had a couple more that was getting trying to get.
Okay, so we're going to do one or two more. You haven't spoken yet. That's one.
Actually, he's had his hand up for a long time.
Yeah, I'm trying to speak.
One, two, three, and then we're going to wrap up. And if people can dialogue with each other. So I also want to give a little time for folks to say something, a little time for folks to say something in terms of the wrap up.
Do you all want to forego the wrap up so we can have more time for dialogue, or do you want to do a wrap up?
No, I don't want to do a wrap up.
Because why don't we forego? I would forego it so we can have more people ask questions.
Four or five. Four or five. Go ahead.
Four or five. Peace, brothers and sisters. Thank you for coming out. It is a pleasure. It is a pleasure and an honor to sit at your feet and to learn. And I'm glad that you are alive and well and made it through the struggle thus far. Obviously, we're all still struggling. My question has to do with terminology, particularly with blacks, African-Americans, Afro-Americans, etc. New Africans, etc. I've heard competing schools of thought, competing philosophies about what is most efficient to call ourselves. For example, not limited to, but for example, black versus African-American. From my understanding, in the 70s, black was a term that was more used, and I've heard the argument that we accomplished more under the term being black versus being African-American, which can be looked at as we accomplished more as reformists, but not as revolutionaries. I just want to know your anyone's this thoughts on that particular matter.
Oh, I can do that one?
Yeah.
Give me an easy one. Oh, okay, like, actually, like, briefly on the terminology, for those of us who consider ourselves to be New Africans, it's like, that is like a whole, it's an existence. I mean, it's not just it's not just the equivalent of African American. So it's like, when we say it, it's like we're talking about folks commonly, you know, African folks here who are descendants of slaves, who have the rights, you know, of a nation. Whereas opposed, for a lot of us, we reject the use of the word African-American. You know, we can relate to a lot of African-Americans, but those are folks who still got that little African thing in there. And like, so that's out of it. And you said some other part, too, something about, oh, the difference between revolutionary and reformers?
No.
The terminology?
I was just saying something.
Get more done?
No.
It said, using black term again.
Okay, using black in...
Just to say in the times when we're really doing serious work, the quibble over what we call ourselves is kind of a define. That should be a part of the banter, but the struggle, the work that we do, should be the focus of where we're coming from. Because that's just like, you know, whether we were Negroes or black. When I was coming up, it was in Jet Magazine and everything. Everybody was arguing whether we were Negro or black. But, and people are, you know, it's necessary for us to define ourselves, but really it's more a question of what class enemy do we have. And we know that there is a, now everybody's aware of the class that's exploiting and oppressing us in nationally, internationally.
I know you think this brother thinks me. But he knows me, right?
He's a plant.
I'm a citizen of the Republic of New Africa, and I'm Muslim also. Right? I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I didn't come in from the beginning, but my thing is kind of bifurcated, right, my statement. Right, is one, dealing with the historical context of the Republic of New Africa and the Panther Party, right? There wasn't too much ideological differences between us. As a matter of fact, here in New York City, right, Sophia Bukhari and a bunch of us, we got together and we formed a coalition right here in New York, right? So there wasn't that much of a difference, right? A historical factor that you can look at, right, which is from the enemy, is a book put out by the federal government called Now We Have a Nation. This is about the Republic of New Africa and the Black Panther Party. You can probably get this book through the U.S. government printing office, right? So you want to know how you define yourself and how you're defined by the enemy, right, to get the proper perspective on where you have to go, right? Now, Ashanti Austin, right, sitting right in front of me, I have the utmost respect for him, even though I feel we have some ideological differences. I don't think that they're that great that they can't be overcome, right? And I respect him. One, the brother was mentioning the Chetas, I think, in Mexico, or the Yucatan. I'll call it the Yucatan. But he was there, and I think that to broaden the perspective, right, is that we must be affiliated with these various revolutionary groups to see where we have to go. The last part is something that Brenda said. We don't need people to come in and to define our direction or where we have to go. Right? That's what Malcolm was saying. Malcolm was saying, go to your own communities, educate your people, right? Now, we're not saying we can't work together, but don't define us. Don't come in and try to take over. One of the biggest parts of the American system is cultural imperialism. We have to be careful of that from the highest point to the lowest point. I mean, those people that come into our communities that want to tell us that we are ignorant about certain things, right? That we have to watch out for that. We have to watch out about where they're coming from, right? We got to define ourselves. I think that's one of the biggest things that we have to do. And lastly,
he said I was bi. He said you were bi, and now you came up with three.
We had to deal with, in coming up in the struggle, with less than what they have today. You have a lot of things at your disposal. You have the internet. You have all these things. There's really no excuses, right? We had to deal with mimeographs and things like that, collating by hand.
Walk miles.
And all of the groups. The
back in the
day.
The
Panthers, Republican, New Africa,
all hours.
And various groups in the community. That's how we had to do it. Right? So I hope I gave up something that's useful.
Yes, you did.
So I think we have 1, 2, 3, right? Four.
My name is Khalil Mustafa.
Okay, cool.
But I do want to, because I see people are starting to trickle out, but I wonder if we have a couple of announcements that we want to make. Before that, one thing is if people trickle out, they can leave a little donation as they go. That'd be great because we had folks who spent money making food for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to thank, in particular, Shante and Wendy, who have donated. We also want to make sure we reimburse them as a group and as an organization. So if folks do have to leave a little bit early, let this big hand remind you that we're going to put out here, and when we officially break up, we're going to pass this around. Secondly, that
also our political president committee, one thing that we're really emphasizing is communicating with our political president so that they know that we have not forgotten about them, that they are so important to the work that we're currently doing, and they are still a part of that work. So we send birthday cards every month, and this month coming up is going to be Mamiya's birthday and Charles Africa. So on the way out, if you can just sign a little notation just to let them know that they're all people that know who they are and remember. We want to continue to keep their legacy going.
Second to that, next weekend we're doing a social forum in White Plains. We're a part of it. Ashley Austin is going to be there. Pam Africa, Sanyad Sadiq is going to be there. So if you need more information, just come to me after. I'll be required to write up.
T-shirts. What for MXGM members in particular?
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. If you haven't ordered your shirt yet, have we put it on the listserv? This is the last opportunity. I'm putting in the order. It's going to open on Monday morning. So if you would like to get a shirt and you've already put down your size, please pay for it. If you haven't, give me your size and $10. Thank you. Please and have a good.
No, it's $10. One second. I want to see if people want to finish out the staff. So we had Wale, two, and I know three. Are you sure? Okay. So let's do you two, and then let's finish out those two questions and come back to announcements. Go ahead, Wale.
Quickly, my question was kind of in reference to something that we spoke about.
In terms of
what relationships organizations or what functions organizations like fulfill? I work with the Black student organization on my campus. So in your opinion, what is the role of student organizations in relationship to the campus and affecting change on the campus, but also in relationship to the community, ideally? Like historically, what were the role of Black student organizations or radical Black student organizations in the past? And what do you see as useful as an objective for student organizations?
Well, I think I could speak to the past, but I think you have to define what you think is most important for you to do today. But in the past, we saw the institutions as a resource for the community. So we provided, you need meeting space, you need something copied, you need whatever, that's what we did. And we also coupled with them to do whatever work they were doing. So whatever they were trying to do, we would try to do that. Some, like one example was even in a graduate school, that for the master's degree, we refused to do the traditional master's thesis, but instead we were in a place that was almost like Mississippi. It was in Sacramento, California. People were still living in buildings with stilts and couldn't read and were not registered to vote. So we organized a whole voters a campaign for people to register, for people to learn how to read, and then we did a manual that could then be used by the community groups to be able to carry on that work in other areas. So it's finding what the community needs and finding out how you can contribute. The other third thing right now with the war would be that I think that progressive students, both in college and in elementary school and high school, should join ranks with the parents, with progressive teachers, and they should fight against all encroachment of the military inside of their schools, and also to fight to tell people that they should not register, they should not go. They should not go to fight. So that's something I could see that could be done, but you all have to define that. And that's by going out and asking the community. Like, what's a lot of students came to picture the homeless when they took over the building. There were a lot of youth out there. And they came out, and some people could do very creative work that we can't do or don't have time to do. And they did a lot of great visuals, which is really important. It's not a minor thing, because people coming by want to know, why are you out there? What are you doing? And some young people are very creative, so you can look and see what they've done and what they're saying. So it's finding out, what do you need? How can I help you? NOLA, New York to NOLA, the school, Beacon High School, told them that they weren't going to help them go to the Katrina area, and they were not going to help them go to Cuba. So what do those students do? They organize with other students around the city, and they send them down there. They still go down, and they're setting up, helping people set up communities down there. So there's a lot of stuff to do.
Can I real brief, moderator?
Okay, he's talking. All right. I think also, like, for me, in agreement with Brenda, it's like we need everybody to again think of everything that they do. It's got to be about the liberation of our people. We got a lot of problems. So for me, I look for stuff coming out of the universities and colleges that helps me to understand how much more complex our oppressions are. I need to get to them essays that folks been doing in the new Black Power studies. Mm. I need to understand more of what they call the intersectionality of the different oppressions, to figure out why, like, for example, Black folks, we're trying to liberate ourselves, but we still got to deal with a lot of homophobia and all these other things, you know? So, like, I need, like, thinkings that are coming out of these universities for those of us who are in our communities, so that we can maybe develop some different ways of struggling that doesn't, we don't keep repeating our own undoing, in a sense, you know? We got to figure out, that's why, like, within Malcolm X grassroots movement, the fight for the seven principles is so important. You know, we got to figure out how to bring our fractured community together so that we can be the force to liberate ourselves, you know, and all the other stuff. So what y'all are doing there is very important. It's not just skills you're learning, but it's like you got a chance to learn a lot of new cutting edge revolutionary thinking as well, and we need it.
Last question.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, the Black liberation struggles, you know, of the 60s and 70s, like, a radical break with what came before. And I'm wondering, like, how, when y'all were involved in those struggles at their height, you know, like, how did you relate to the previous generation at the time? And, like, how did they view you and understand you when you were making breaks with what was happening before? And at the same time, that's sort of a question for me, for, like, younger generation folks in the audience, like, how are we going to relate to elders in the struggle right now, knowing that things today will be different? You know, like, what's the relationship that can nurture movements now, knowing that there will be differences and we may come to some different conclusions?
You know, actually, since we're not going to go back to that format you said before, I'm not going to get a chance to do his five statements. Unless I do it now. Okay. When I said about the five states, I was actually, remember now, I was addressing that to the Malcolm X grassroots movement. And it's not, I don't expect everybody in here too. It would be nice, you know, for them to know. And when we talk about even things like the Black student unions, it's like a lot of folks knew about, like, things like Obama. And that was all cool. But for a lot of us in the independence movement, it wasn't about Obama. So it was another sidetrack. But at the same time, if we ask them about the independence movement here, they don't know. You know, you wouldn't know. So all your energy is going one way, and that does relate to the struggle around political prisoners and POW. You're fighting for somebody, but you don't really know their struggles. And I think if people study it also, be a thing if they would understand what they would know, like the Republican New Africa. Actually, what came out was the establishment of an independent socialist nation. So it's like, you know, class contradictions are known, but at the same time, everybody that's involved in the independence movement isn't a revolutionary. You know, so that's those revolutionary formations. That's their job to make sure that that struggle for independence isn't subverted into something like some other places where, like, independent but still have the same oppressive system. But students, we really think they need to know more. Because in the 70s, they did. You know, the black law students would be over here, a black health workers, whatever. Some of the things that people mentioned, those folks would use whatever they learned in those places of learning and bring it back to the community. Give the state?
Well, just real quickly with you guys, what I'm looking for is...
Let's do private dialogue afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. Let you guys have final word, and then we're going to close out.
No, I just want to talk about the break with the past and the consistency of the break with the past. Of course, the past is also Nat Turner.
Exactly. Yes.
For us. Okay. You understand? Yeah. The That's past right. is also Harriet Tubman and some very revolutionary people. Yeah. So we broke with the past that was holding us back from taking steps forward in the movement that were not conscious and revolutionary. But we wanted to be connected to the most progressive and to understand and follow in the steps of the most progressive and militant sectors of the past and break with the ones that were backwards leaning and not taking us forward. So that's all I wanted to say on that.
Good point.
Yeah, the thing is, what I think is might happen is that there may not be any break. It might be just an interpretation. The whole thing is that I think as everybody gets older, you're going to evolve or see things in a different manner. And so some people are going to identify with Nat Turner. Some people are going to, you know, go back to the debate between Du Bois and Garvey. And some people are going to do some other things. And so people are going to connect. That's how I see what happened to me. I had all those dialogues, all that history, and I just connected to what I saw was best for me and made sense to me, the building of an independent nation for black people. And so did I break from, what past did I break from? I broke from King, maybe, or did I break from Malcolm? You know, I just see that you're going to follow and you're going to stand on the shoulders of your ancestors. And you're not going to really make no break because there's a connection. You're connected somehow to whatever you start doing. It's going to be their energy carrying you forward.
Can I just add one? I mean, I think that question also, just tying into what both of them have said, there was always different tendencies in everybody's movement. There wasn't one movement and everybody followed. So you had, and some things that people did a certain time that might not seem revolutionary now were revolutionary then. If you walked up the steps of a county house to register and know that you could be shot in the back going in there, you're going to lose your job, or somebody might be lynched, to me that's revolutionary. It might not be revolutionary now to go down and register on the form, but there you were taking known risk to do that. And so every movement, they had a legislative, legal approach, they had an armed struggle approach, they had a reform approach. So every movement, not just ours, every movement had those different tendencies in it. So when you say a break from the past, it's too general, and I think that that's what both of them were speaking to understand what you're talking about. And it's a class issue, too. Yeah. There was also class interest then, and there's class interest now, that dictated the strategy and tactics that people took to fight for liberation.
On that note, we're going to wrap up, and I want to thank all speakers. We'll give a round of applause.
Thank you.
Continuity and organizations working together for a larger purpose. So thank you.